Welcome back. This is Midday Mobile on FM Talk 106.5. And as I mentioned earlier, checking in all the way from Russia to talk about not far enough east in Russia to really get into a full discussion of the lands Genghis Khan and the Mongols put their feet on. But maybe, I don't know. It is Don Lessem of the Great Civilizer, the Genghis Khan exhibit coming to that's at the Explorium now. Also, a lot of us know him as Dino Don. Is there a reason we know you as Dino Don?
If you're under 10 and you love dinosaurs, it's because I do just about everything I can legally with dinosaurs. I've written 50 books, worked on the Jurassic Park series, make dinosaur exhibits and tour, including one many years ago at the Explorium in Mobile. And I used to do a column in Highlights magazine, you know, the one in the dentist's office?
Oh, yeah.
For Ask Dino Don questions about dinosaurs. And I think I answered 11,000 letters from kids.
Well, that's why I was and their parents and adults as well, because I was familiar with your name from the world of dinosaurs before I saw the exhibit. I saw that the exhibit for Genghis Khan was coming to the Explorium, but I then saw your name. I said, holy cow, this is Don Lessem, like Dinosaur Don Lessem. He's coming to town. And I guess before we go any further, too, I've got to establish this.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about Genghis Khan or Genghis Khan. Which one is it, Don?
It's both, believe it or not. The real answer is neither. The way it's pronounced in Mongolia is Chinggis, like C-H.
Chinggis.
But,
okay.
Yeah, but we got to kind of the way that we do, changing it that's more comfortable for us to pronounce. And, in the Middle East, it's Genghis. So I think he would answer to any name. It's okay.
All right. he would just Khan, I guess. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the exhibit going on at the Explorium right now about Genghis Khan. And you, the very provocative here, when we see the name Genghis Khan, and we see the great civilizer. Now, Don, the great civilizer, what do you mean great civilizer? This was the barbarian's barbarian.
Oh, you're setting me up, Sean. That was our impression, and this was the time when the losers wrote the history, because not only was he a great winner, the greatest conqueror ever, but he also brought the most peaceful and largest empire in the history of the world together. He provided freedom of religion. He had trial by jury. He brought us all kinds of things like diplomatic immunity, passports, and things from everyday life, like I hope you're wearing pants today, but pants is an invention of Genghis Khan, at least for the West. And lemons, violins, all kinds of things that we think are ours came from the Eastern civilizations that he amalgamated and brought to us.
Well,
we owe a great deal to him.
Yeah, and well, I want to get to this too. I mean, I know I'm jumping around here some, but the font of the steps there and the steppe people culture, you got the idea of bringing the story of Genghis Khan to the rest of us because you were in Mongolia, not looking at history, but looking at deep, deep history, right? I mean, you were there for dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's one of the great places in the world for dinosaurs. And the real Indiana Jones, there was a real character that he's based on, in the 1920s, found the first nest of eggs in Mongolia. So I always wanted to come here. And so 30 years ago was my first trip, and it made many since. When I got here, I saw all these things about Genghis Khan. This, you know, the airport is named for him, the airplane, the beer, the hotels. There's even a Genghis Khan Irish bar. So, you know, they clearly had a different impression of him than I did if they were advertising him like that. And sure enough, that's how I discovered it. And I thought, oh, you know, this is a story to be told. You know, an amazing accomplishment that we don't take for what it is.
So he's the George Washington of Mongolia?
Well, he's even more. He's the George Washington plus the Abraham Lincoln plus a little bit of God all in one. You know, he's the reason they have a written language. He's the reason they have a country and once the greatest empire. So, you know, they owe him their lives.
And just joining us, talking to Don Lessem, who is the curator and exhibitor for the Great Civilizer Genghis Khan exhibit right now at the Explorium. And we will get into some dinosaur talk here in a little bit. But I want to run through this talk about the Khan because, you know, I've read the books. I paid a little bit of attention in school and then read the books as an adult of the conquest of Genghis Khan. And sure, I see that there's the civilizing influence of conquest and this empire put through. But to get there, I mean, a pretty bloody cost. He didn't just come in and say, hey, I think it'd be really nice if y'all became part of our empire here. And I sure would like you to be pals with us. I mean, this came at the point of a sword or, you know, at the point of a spear.
Well, yeah, maybe he brought them just baklava and they were very happy. He is the reason we have that, too. But no, he did do a great deal through intimidation and fear. So not all these conquests were by battle. Nonetheless, you're right. It was a bloody time. The Crusaders were horribly bloody guys. But it's what he did afterwards, which is to create this largest peaceful empire for everybody. A real meritocracy. But yeah, he was a brilliant general. And we really present the two faces of the exhibit. The civilizer, but also the conqueror. And, you know, they still teach at West Point some of the strategies that he developed, and they're absolutely brilliant, and we try and display them in a very vivid way in the exhibit without the blood or the heads rolling.
Well, those techniques, yeah, they are, I mean, number one, like you said, taught at West Point. If you go back and look at battle tactics, even for modern warfare, a lot of the generals take ideas that were presented in the 1200s and put them into place in modern times on the battlefields out there, and won with them as well.
Yeah, and, you know, one we sort of vividly present in the exhibit is that they would often, the Mongols, attack and then pretend they were defeated. And in retreating, the enemy, of course, would lose its formation and kind of string out, and the Mongols would retreat to some place where they could, ambush the enemy. And, of course, they could do it over and over again. If they kill everybody, nobody knows the secret.
That's true. And I want to get into, I mean, part of that is like I would read that the army would, Genghis Khan would send troops back after they went to whatever city in the steppe or even in Eastern Europe or the Middle East. After they defeated the enemy there, they would send part of the army back a couple days later to mop up anybody that they hadn't gotten in the first round. I mean, they sterilized some of the places that they conquered.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that this was a universal truth, but it's actually not. That what they would do, too, is they would leave one or two people. So they would go to the next town and tell them about what the disaster was that they had experienced, and then the next town would surrender even before Genghis Khan attacked. You have to remember that, you know, the Mongolians never were a huge population, and his army was 100,000 people at the most, attacking armies 7-10 times as large. So it's not in his interest to wage a war if he could engineer a defeat without it. So,
yeah.
he did a lot of strategies to vanquish his enemies without putting his own troops in danger.
Well, that's one of the things about intimidation I've read before. I'd like your take on it, that he would be so brutal. He and his generals, his army, would be so brutal in a given city, in a given area, with the hope, I guess, and I don't know if it was written down or not, the hope that that message, like you said, would be carried on and other people would surrender to the Mongols.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a great PR campaign. He had spies hidden within the merchant caravans to spread the word that they were coming and exaggerate their numbers. And, you know, he did things like when he's getting to walled cities, which was a real challenge for a mobile army to attack, he would set the whole hillside around the city ablaze with campfires, and he would put also fake soldiers on wicker horses. So it looked like from a distance his army was at night, and particularly from a distance, 10 times as big as it was.
Yeah, that was the old light the five fires, right? Each soldier was supposed to light five fires to make the enemy think there were more of them camped before the battle.
Right, and then he had such clever strategies that he developed for getting into walled cities, which we also presented in a way in the exhibit, along with some of the catapults and battering rams. But he would do things like reroute a river to go through a town, or put explosives, which he got gunpowder from China, and underground, or he'd fill the moat with the people from the last city. It's very economical. Mm-hmm. And so ride over them, or the most notorious of all, two were actually, he would take marmots like groundhogs that came from Mongolia and carry the bubonic plague to which his troops would be immune, shoot it over the walls of the city, let them get into the water supply of the city, and everybody would get the plague, and he'd just wait until it was done.
Wait a second, Don. Yeah. You're telling me that Genghis Khan was using weapons of mass destruction. He was using biological warfare. Well, in the 1100s, 1200s.
All right. Absolutely, and the last was even I guess you could call this biological warfare, and the ASPCA would definitely not approve. He would lure cats and dogs out of cities with food, set fire to their tails, and of course, in their panic, they would run back into the city and set fire to the town.
He's using all different types of systems of warfare. I want to get back to it, but I do want to talk about when we show up at the Explorium and we see this exhibit. I read it said visitors will experience the exhibition through the eyes of a Mongolian resident. And take us from there. How does this work?
Sure. The ticket that you get when you walk in the exhibit gives you an identity. And so you are at random, a spy, a princess, or a soldier, a general, and all these are based on real people who lived at that time. And as you go gallery to gallery, which are, the galleries are laid out in the order of his life. So he starts out as a poor outcast in the desert, and so you have that setting. You end up with his grandson, Kublai Khan, 100 years later, ruling China in a Chinese palace. But as you go through each of these galleries and all these artifacts, more than have ever been presented from his time, you have touch screens in each gallery, and you match that to your character and find out what happened to you as a spy or a general, whatever, during the 100 years. It usually ends up badly for you, I'll tell you that.
Oh, darn it. Don, when we go and we learn about the life here, you talk about the early life of Genghis Khan. One of the old stories is that he killed his brother for stealing food. Is that dealt with in this, and is that true in your research?
Yeah, but who hasn't done that, really, Sean?
Just today. So that story is, it seems part of the mythos, but can you vet that out, that is part of the history?
Yeah. Well, the way we know so much about him, actually, we do know a great deal, is that one of the first books in that region ever written, or at least that we found, is called The Secret History of the Mongols, and was written about 20 years after he died, and is not particularly flattering. It's a very mixed portrait. He's afraid of wives, his number one wife, he's afraid of dogs. But it's very accurate about a lot of things that happened in his life, and so that's where we get the drama of his early life. He was, there were no Mongols. He was just a small tribe, a Mongolian tribe, among many tribes in the Central Asian steppes. And he put them together for the first time. But as a kid, his father had been poisoned by his rivals. He and his brothers and his mother were outcasts, living by their wits for 3 years. And the older brother, actually half-brother, was stealing the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches from everybody. So at age 8, Genghis organized his younger brother to shoot him.
And
they had very little food to live on. You couldn't afford to have somebody stealing their food.
And so that is borne out in with that. Then he goes and he moves on. You're talking about the other warring tribes, and they're there in the steppes of Mongolia. How do you go from getting the idea to do something bigger than just fight your neighboring tribe, right? Because that's what goes on with a lot of people back then. It's that tribe over there. There's only so many resources. We're going to go to war against them, get the resources, and then we'll go back to doing our thing.
Absolutely. That was the tradition for centuries, and it produced this, endless series of wars. What he realized was, and maybe because he was an outcast himself, why not incorporate the vanquished into his own army and his own society? So he would make, after he won the battle, he would make their best general his general and mix the two. And so as he conquered more and more of this region, he built up an integrated army of all these different tribes and really created a nation and an empire. So, it's really kind of a mystery that he could figure all this out as an illiterate outcast. He already had, before he became emperor, he had written down for him the laws of his empire. So he felt that he was destined to rule the world, and sure enough, he was.
We're talking to Don Lessem, and of course, the exhibit now at the Explorium. You got to check it out. Genghis Khan, the Great Civilizer. Hey, Don, what about the, speaking of incorporating defeated armies, or at least those that performed well out of the defeated armies into his Mongol army, what about the story of, was it an archer that had shot this horse out from under Genghis Khan or something like that, that he said, you're really good. I want you to be part of my crew.
Absolutely. You know, his standard was interesting, which is if he saw someone brilliant, he took them in. If someone came to him and said, I'll give you information about, as a spy, about the army that I'm working for, he would have them killed. He said, you're not capable of loyalty to your own people. Why should I think you're going to be loyal to me? And one of his greatest generals said, I would like a bigger appointment. I'm so good. Make me the leader of a whole, infantry. He said, no, you're much too good. People can't emulate you. They can't copy what you do. You don't understand what the average guy is like. You're not fit to command them. It's very interesting.
And with the conquest that went on, I got to ask this. This is more kind of the warfare nerd discussion here, but the implements used. Now, you talk about dealing with walled cities and some of the challenges that these mounted cavalries, basically, of Genghis Khan dealt with going across the steppe and then on into Europe, and I guess back actually going east further into China.
Yes.
But they had the advantage, the Mongol bow, which is still discussed. Look at this Mongol bow. Was this piece of archery equipment just different because it looked different? Or do you feel like they had, I look at this, I wonder, was that the big arms, was it the atomic weapon, maybe not that far, of their
day? Absolutely. No, you're right. It's the intercontinental ballistic missile when everybody else's was not intercontinental.
Okay.
We still use that recurve bow now because it's twice as powerful as the longbow, which was the best thing the Europeans had going. And so, the Mongol innovation could fire an arrow twice as far. It took enormous strength. You had to have a ring on your finger so it didn't pop your thumb off. And it's 80 pounds of pressure. Any guy out there who's ever fired a bow knows it took incredible strength to do it. But you could, they could stay out of reach on their horses of the enemy, kill them all, and no one could even get close to them. In fact, in the exhibit, we have this one of the many arrowheads from his time. It's there, has two holes in it, because if you fire that, it whistles. And he would shoot it over the heads of the enemy. They would realize, oh, my God, we can't even reach Genghis's army, and they can shoot over our heads already. We surrender.
Oh, wow.
So it's an incredible weapon. Plus, they had these very mobile horses, tiny ponies. You could... Your feet, Sean, would touch the ground in these, but they are very durable and they gallop at a very even pace. So you can shoot hanging under the horse because the horse is wearing armor just like you are. Nobody can reach you and you're firing on a very stable platform. It's amazing what they could do as archers. And of course, the horses didn't even need to be provisioned. We have to have a supply train, in our traditions. They could feed themselves in winter. They just paw the grass away. And so that's why where I am in Russia, they conquered all of Russia, which Napoleon and Hitler couldn't do in winter. Genghis Khan got through it in months.
It's unreal. And Don, I want to talk about that because you're there in Russia. So, you think about an empire that stretched. We talk about the Roman Empire. We talk about great empires, the English Empire, British, what they did. But to look at the physical landmass that was, and I don't know, fully occupied, but let's say had control of outposts for Genghis Khan. It stretched from the definition of Far East of China to Europe.
Yeah, and at the height of the empire, which is actually after his time, his sons and Kublai Khan, his grandson, who's the first to ever put China under one rule. So it goes all the way from the Pacific across all of Asia to Vienna in Austria. And the only reason that they stopped in Vienna was that Genghis's son, who was then in charge after he had died, he himself died, and so they always elected the Khan. So they went back. It's actually a small army that he had because he didn't need much to defeat the Europeans who were very primitive. They left Vienna, interrupted their conquest, and then they decided it's not worth going back. Europe is a backward place without a lot of money, unlike Persia and these other wealthy kingdoms in China. So they decided, no, there's no good grazing for our horses. The heck with this place. So we were only, you know, one battle away from all of Europe being Mongolian.
Wow. Wow. And I want to jump back to one thing. You mentioned the horses again, which just thinking about these stories I've read over time, that I don't know if it was Genghis Khan or a general or something that decided when conquering some group in Asia Minor or somewhere in there, that they might as well remove these people and their farming, their basic farming, because that land looked like it was, well, that was good grazing ground for horses. And why would you want to have people farming it when you could have, like you said, good pasture? I mean, it was ingrained. I mean, these folks were almost born on a horse, right? And everything they thought about was pasture and nomadic.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things in the exhibit that I most enjoy, and I think people do too, is we have Mongolian live performers, musicians, because the culture there in the countryside is still exactly the same. It's the last horse culture in the world. People are still nomad. Genghis Khan never even slept indoors. He was only in a building once in his life. And so Mongolians still live exactly that. They still play the same music. It's the same songs he listened to. And so we have these Mongolian artists who come and they sing and they dance three times a day, every day, the same songs that he would have listened to, which is, you know, that's an amazing thing to think about.
No, it's amazing that at that point, here we are at, you know, 1100, 1200, the dominant, the superpower, right? The superpower of that time period, the biggest superpower on planet Earth. But now you're telling us, you know, all this time later, it's pretty much not changed. Not much has changed. They hit their zenith back then, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. You know, now, you know, it's, who knows, Mongolia, it's, you know, 100,000 people go there a year. It's the least populated country per square mile in the world. It's the worst weather. It's the furthest from the ocean. So it's pretty isolated right now. But to think that they had an empire four times as big as Alexander the Great or the Roman Empire, you know, bigger than anything that ever was. So it's quite the contrast from what he built to what it is now.
I wonder why that is, that we in the West, and maybe it is something as simple as, you know, Western civilization versus Eastern, but you mentioned Alexander the Great. We talk about the Roman Empire. Listen, we had to sit in class. We had to know about that. We had tests on that. We had quizzes on that. We had papers on that. We only briefly talked about Genghis Khan.
Yeah. We didn't even mention him, period, in mine, and I'm a little older than you, but we did, you know, except for a bloody movie and maybe Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure,
right.
Night at the Museum, you know, or maybe a restaurant. You never hear of Genghis Khan, and it's ridiculous when you think about it. You know, like Time Magazine voted him the man of the millennium several years ago. And so he is, you know, you can make an argument that, and I'm not being hyperbolic, that since Jesus, maybe, or Muhammad, he's the most influential character in history.
Wow.
Because he was the one who united East and West as in trade routes, and in the most permanent way. And so everything that we have absorbed in our culture, which is enormous, from the East, comes from him. So he was the real world builder. And even though his empire didn't last, his influence is absolutely all with us. So it's really kind of a racist thing that we don't celebrate him. And at his time, guys like Chaucer, you know, the great English writer, talked about what a great guy he was. It just took a while for us to, you know, the PR to go the wrong way.
Yeah, of course, if you are one of the people that's left after whatever it was, 30, 40 million people had been slain
right, by
the Mongols. If you're one of those, or those are your kinfolk, you probably didn't think he was so great. But for the rest of the folks, speaking of which, actually, okay, man, it's so great to have you on here. And if you're just joining us, Don Lessem, who is the man behind Genghis Khan, the great civilizer that is on display right now at the Explorium here in Mobile. What about this stat? I don't even have the stat off the top, but there's a certain percentage of the population on the planet that has the straight genetic link to Genghis Khan. He was a ladies' man, right? Even if they didn't want to be his mate, right?
Yes, he had a good dating strategy, which is, you don't go out with me, I kill you.
Yeah.
So that was very effective. You know, when you talk about people who might be resentful of him because they're ancestors, it's much more likely that your ancestors have his blood because he had 500 girlfriends, five wives, and then he's, of course, killing off the most powerful people in the opposing races. So there's, you know, they've actually been able to trace a genetic blip, you know, at the time of the 13th century where a certain chromosomal allele traced to Genghis Khan's time shows that his influence was enormous. The estimates range, but it's up to 8% of all Asians and 1% of all Westerners are related to him.
Wow.
That's
all
millions,
these
millions of people, and not one of them writes to him.
But I mean, it was wild to think about. But you make a good case. I mean, he's got all these partners, all this progeny. At the same time, the other people that might have been putting their genetics in the mix might have been stacked in a moat so the army could cross into the next walled city.
That's right. And, you know, there is a thing called the Mongolian spot.
Yeah, what
Many
is that?
People, Eastern European people have this kind of a purple blotch on their butt. I would be amazed how many people know this, but unless you have one, maybe. And that is said to be from the influence of Mongolian genes.
Wow. Well, Don, I want to talk about, you're talking about the great civilizer here for Genghis Khan. And you mentioned that they were into Europe, but there wasn't much to do there. They weren't quite impressed with it. But you can argue through this, I think, fairly, civilizer and also maybe the spark that made Europe so powerful. I mean, I've read that the Renaissance happened because Genghis Khan happened.
Yeah, you know, the introduction of all these technologies that come from him. I mean, things like as simple as charcoal or as complicated as gunpowder. There's even a book now by a very distinguished scholar who celebrated Genghis Khan that the American Revolution was heavily influenced, especially Thomas Jefferson, by the writings about Genghis Khan. One of the most popular books in his day in America was a biography of Genghis Khan. And, of course, Genghis Khan had all these democratic principles within his empire. And so it's a really weird thing to think that democracy has a great deal to do with Genghis Khan.
Wow. And we're going to learn more about this at the exhibit here at the Explorium, Genghis Khan, the Great Civilizer. Don, before we finish up, I can't have you on the phone and not ask a couple dinosaur questions. Is that okay?
You only get 17.
Okay. All right. Good. Well, and then people will know, number one, from the books. And I want to ask the broad question here, because you mentioned it earlier. You said you write for Highlights. You write these children's books, 50-some-odd books about dinosaurs. What the heck happens? Because I have watched it with my two children, and I didn't believe it. I thought my children were above average, and they won't fall into that trap. Both of my children fascinated with dinosaurs when they were young. We talked about them. I stepped on more hardened dinosaur plastic toys in my house than even Legos. And now as they get into their, 10, 12, 13, 14 years, it goes away. I don't know what happens to us. I mean, why is it not sticking with people?
Well, first of all, you should be grateful that they were, because there actually was a study lately that the kids who are obsessed with dinosaurs do much better in school.
Good deal.
Yeah, but one of the things is I think it's a genetic defect, frankly. Between the ages of like 3 and 8, it is this obsession. And it's across cultures. You see it all over the world. And then it passes, you're right. So even within the 3 to 8 period, kids start off, with the Barney fantasy dinosaur that soon becomes about naming dinosaurs. Then it's about, collecting them, different kinds. Then it's about excavation, and so it has many forms, but really it's sort of a transitional period between monsters and fantasy and reality. So these are monsters, but they were real. On the other hand, they're not under the bed, so
right.
It's safe. And a little boy can project himself as T-Rex and be the scary guy who could, every time his parents yell at them, he could eat them. So it's a good solution for them. What happens is, baseball, girls, all kinds of other things. By the way, girls are certainly interested in dinosaurs, too, when they're young. But you're right. And those kids, all the kids I met, hundreds of thousands who say that they're going to be dinosaur scientists when they grow up, there are 35 guys who dig dinosaurs, guys and girls, in the world.
Wow.
It didn't work.
Yeah, it's the numbers are not coming back here. You have a good pool to work with from 3 to 8 years old, but it's winnowed down heavily before you get to the, where you're actually doing it for a living. Speaking of which, in doing research.
Oh, I was just going to say, Sean, but the other thing is, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but the thing is that what I love about it is that it teaches them how to ask and how to look and how to find answers. And then the interest in science doesn't go away. So a lot of kids will move on to, you know, either horses or sharks or something else and apply that same system of learning about stuff themselves that they picked up in the first place from dinosaurs. And so it's big. And then a lot of dinosaur scientists today actually come out of Jurassic Park. The teenagers who got into dinosaurs, which never used to be, those people do become dinosaur scientists.
So out of the fantasy, I mean, because I've heard you speak before that even though you had your name was on the papers there around Jurassic Park, you were a consultant on it, that we saw a lot of things in that movie that probably wouldn't be borne out by science.
Oh, yeah. No, I was complaining every minute of it, and they were saying, shut up. You know. So that was my primary role, was to complain. They have a story in that movie, and they were following the story, and it really varies enormously from the truth. But you know, if you told the real story of dinosaurs, it would be the worst movie in the world. They go to the bathroom and they go to sleep for 2 hours. And 1 out of 10 times a T-Rex catches something and 9 times it misses. I would not want to watch that movie.
Well said. What, anything you can give us on the horizon here? I mean, are you paced for dinosaur discovery on this planet? Has it slowed? Is it in neutral? Is it speeding up? And do you see anything on the horizon for us to be looking at for trends or discoveries or putting things together?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is the golden age of dinosaurs, in case you were wondering whether this is a good time to be alive. If you love dinosaurs, absolutely. In the last 20 years, we found more dinosaurs than in the entire history of science before that. And now the pace is double what it was a couple of years ago. So it means that every 2 weeks, there's a new kind of dinosaur found.
Oh, wow.
Plus, almost everything we know about their behavior is known now. And so much more, you know, the tools are still the same. You dig a hole, or actually what happens is somebody finds a dinosaur. You don't know where to look. And maybe it's good, maybe it's bad. Somebody goes out and digs and finds it. But we now have tools to analyze it that we never had. So we actually do have DNA from dinosaurs right in their bones. I don't know if this is going to lead to ever wanting to or being able to remake a dinosaur, but that shows you the level of information that we get now from them.
But so wait a second. So you're circling back the idea of the mosquito and the amber there from Jurassic Park. It's not that same channel, but with the DNA, do you believe you could recreate a dinosaur?
Well, first, let me take you the movie scenario is so bogus because we never found mosquitoes with blood from that time. If you did, you wouldn't know whose blood it was, which animal. Then they mixed it with a frog, I think, in the movie. And the nearest relation, of course, is a bird alive today. And so none of that works. And in fact, I knew Michael Crichton well, the guy who wrote it. That's how I got involved. And I said, you know, this doesn't make any sense at all. He said, yeah, I know. I just kind of skipped that part. So that's not the strategy. But even with the DNA we have, imagine that you had a phone book. And the phone book is all the DNA information you need for an animal. We have one line in the book. It says Sean, instead of the 7 billion people who lived in the world. So we're not anywhere close to that. But what we could do in some time, I think, I'm not sure we should, is take that information we have, mix it with a bird, which is still a dinosaur, in fact, and you could eventually, you know, by appearance, come up with something that looked like a dinosaur. It'd be 99% chicken and tastes like one, but it could look like a dinosaur. In a long while, you could do that, but at great expense. And the thing to remember is that the dinosaurs couldn't live today. The air has changed. The plants have changed. Even if you brought them back, they'd fall over.
Well, that's saving grace for all of us, you know, that are here for human beings. It's probably a good thing.
Right.
Before we wrap up here,
but they would get a good agent this time because they never made a buck off those movies.
That's
and
true.
Probably ticked off.
They get the residuals.
The only reason, by the way, that I stuck with that movie because there wasn't very much for me to do in truth, except correct a few lines that I could change, was that I asked Spielberg at the end, I want all the sets and the props, and I'm going to make a museum exhibit about how wrong this is and raise money for research. And nice guy that he was, he said, yeah, he could tell Universal what to do. I don't think I could tell Universal what to do. And so he made them give us all the stuff. And we raised $3 million for research, which actually spurred a lot of these discoveries.
Amazing. I know there's so much on the dinosaur side. We're going to have you back on the show one day in the future to talk about. So I will jump us from the Jurassic or the Cretaceous to 1100, 1200. Genghis Khan, remind folks once again, coming out to the Explorium, talk about Genghis Khan, the great civilizer, why they should stop in and say hello to this guy from back in the 1200s.
Oh, absolutely. Well, for one, I would get about a quarter if you go. So, you know, I have children,
right?
And you should be feeling for them. No, this is the only time this exhibition, which is really a blockbuster around the world, 2 million people have seen it. It's the only time it's going to be in the Gulf Coast area. And, you know, I mentioned the activities and the performers, but there's also amazing objects. I mean, we have things that go back 5,000 years from Mongolia, but also the largest collection of things from his time, from weapons to jewels to costumes, that has ever been displayed. And it's only here for 3 months, which I know sounds like a long time, but it passes quickly. And, you know, it's just, I think you'll find it the way I did, because I'm an amateur. I'm not some scholar about Genghis Khan. It's just an eye-opening experience. It changes your whole way of looking at our world. And that's why I did it, and I think that's why you'd love it.
I think I will. Don Lessem, thank you for your time. Thanks for bringing this exhibit to Mobile, and I can't wait to talk to you again very soon.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to go see Putin and see what he has to say about our elections.
There you go. Thank you for that. Checking in live from Russia, Dino Don Lessem, the curator and exhibitor of Genghis Khan, the Great Civilizer, at the Mobile Explorium.